Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. And today, we're going to continue our discussion of fiscal matters. This time, we're going to look at the tax side of the picture. I've been saying for quite some time that taxes are the glue to this deficit cutting that's been going on. We saw that with the fiscal cliff. That's what made the deal. And I've been predicting that's what will make the deal again. And the gorilla here in the closet is the tax code overhaul. Okay, we'll see how this plays out over the next several weeks. As we all know, we have a temporary, emphasis temporary, solution to the government shutdown and the debt ceiling here a couple weeks ago. And we talked about that at length. And since then, what they've essentially done is Congress and the administration is, instead of kicking the can down the road, they kicked it off the curb. In other words, just for a short period of time. And what we have is the deficit committee of 29. I remember we used to have the super committee when we had the 2011 deal, and they were supposed to come to agreement before the end of the year, and they didn't. They kicked the can down the road until after the elections. Okay, so now we got a committee of 29 in the House and Senate, 22 from the Senate, 7 from the House, chaired by Patty Murray, Democrat in the Senate, and Paul Ryan, Republican in the House. And we have a December 13th deadline, another phony deadline, in which both sides are supposed to come to some sort of agreement on the budget and the funding of the government. And we have a deadline, a January 15th of next year. And if they don't come to an agreement by the 13th, well, after that's really the 15th, then we have another government shutdown looming. And then we have the debt ceiling deadline, which has been extended to February 7th, 2014. So they've broken out these two. You know, the fact that they both came together here in the recent crisis in October caused them all kind of fits. So they're going to try to take them one at a time, they meaning Republicans and Democrats. And the first one's the government shutdown, January 15th. Okay. And behind all this is the sequester cuts. We started talking about that last week. We'll have a few more things to say about them. That's the $1.2 trillion that was agreed to in the Budget Control Act of August 2011 when they cut $1 trillion in discretionary spending immediately and $1.2 trillion in sequestered, put it off until the debt ceiling issue and the Bush tax cuts, the fiscal cliff, last January 1st, right, kicked it down the road, the sequester cuts, the $1.2 trillion over a decade, kicked it down the road another 60 days, March, started to go into effect in March. But the impact has not really been fully felt. Now it will be fully felt. And why is that? Well, because the 8% across the board cuts in discretionary spending in all government departments have been sort of minimized, marginalized. How? Well, the departments, you know, giving people furloughs and not filling positions and holding off investments and spending, you know, sort of short-term fixes here temporarily. But now we're going to see $109 billion cut next year, well, in this budget. $109 billion of the federal government, according to the sequestered cuts. That's going to have an impact. Okay. All right. And keep in mind, it's more than $109 billion out of GDP because we have a multiplier effect. You know, the multiplier effect is the government spends or cuts X amount of money, but then that money doesn't turn over several times, government spending about a 2 two-time multiplier. So we're really cutting out about $200 billion, at least, out of GDP. We'll talk about that and what that all means. So what are the opening positions here of the two sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, as we now move towards the December 13th phony deadline to reach agreement on both the sequestered cuts and the budget, Obama's next budget, government spending? There's two elements here. Sequestered cuts, you know, are we going to suspend those? Which ones? And then there's the general budget. What are we going to do with that? And the 13th is the deadline, December 13th. Okay, so what's the Democrats' public opening position? Well, that position is Senator Reid, who leads the House, the Democratic House, is proposing about $950 billion in tax hikes, closing of loopholes and corporate subsidies. One. Two, the Democrats have agreed to restore $54 billion of defense sequestered cuts. All right, restore that. And then to consider, you know, what other discretionary cuts? You see, there's discretionary cuts, you know, stuff like education and transport, so on and so forth. And then there's entitlements, different laws say you got to spend so much. Entitlements mean Social Security, Medicare, et cetera. All right? So we're looking at a possible of $967 billion next year of discretionary spending. And, you know, what are they going to cut out of that? And then we have the entitlements. What are they going to cut out of that? Social Security, Medicare. Now, the Democrats are saying we will consider cutting Social Security and Medicare if you Republicans consider raising taxes, closing these loopholes, corporate subsidies. Okay, so discretionary cuts of something taken out of the $967 billion. Of spending on discretionary spending, and we got entitlement cuts, and Obama, as I've said several times before, has already proposed cutting $630 billion out of Social Security and Medicare, including significantly reducing the annual cost of living adjustments by introducing a chained CPI. Okay, that's $630 billion, by the way, over a decade. All this is over a decade. Okay. So that's the Democrat position. Raise taxes, $950 billion, loopholes and subsidies, restore defense spending, sequester cuts, consider some amount from non-defense discretionary cuts, and agree to some sort of Social Security, Medicare cuts if we get some tax loophole closings and so forth. Now, what's the Republican position? Republicans are saying no tax hikes of any kind, you know, no reduction of corporate subsidies, no reduction of loopholes. We're going to talk about some of these loopholes shortly here. So no tax increase of any kind, and agreed, yes, let's restore the $54 billion in defense cuts. So, conclusion. Number one, both parties have agreed in principle to restore all the defense cuts. But neither of them have agreed to restore any of the non-defense cuts. In fact, both are willing to discuss how to continue and how much to continue of the non-defense spending sequestered cuts, totaling almost $600 billion over the coming decade. They're committed to cutting discretionary spending in the sequester, non-defense side, and they're both committed to restoring the defense cuts. Okay, what are we talking about when we say discretionary spending cuts? Well, the Republicans are talking about, let's cut food stamps even more. Let's cut farm subsidies to smaller farmers particularly. Let's cut Obamacare, ACA, Affordable Care Act. Let's cut federal workers' retirements. And, of course, the Republicans are really aggressively in favor of cutting entitlements, Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Okay. So, That's the opening salvos of both sides here. And in fact, today they are meeting, first time. First meeting is occurring with Murray and Ryan in this Committee of 29. And they will be discussing, beginning discussions along these lines. How much, if any, taxes the hike, right? Restoring the defense cuts. How much discretionary non-defense spending to cut and what? And whether to attack entitlements. Republicans, of course, very much committed to that. And Democrats, committed in principle, if you can give us some smoke and mirrors cover on loophole closings. Now, this is the first time in the last 4 years that both the House and Senate have budget proposals. So that's a strong indication that they will probably come to some sort of agreement of some kind. Just a question of how broad, what's the scope of that agreement? Now step back a minute and think about how much we've cut already discretionary spending. In 2011, discretionary spending was $1.347 trillion. We were spending $1.347 trillion. Okay, now we are proposing $0.967 trillion. We've already cut about $400 billion a year out of discretionary spending. $400 billion. Not just $380 billion. Okay, pretty darn close. We are spending, proposing to spend, before we even agree on cuts, almost $400 billion less than we spent in 2011. That's huge. Now, you got to figure there's a multiple of that. Let's say somewhere between 1.5 and 2.0. That's the multiplier for government spending. So we're taking somewhere between $600, $700 billion out of the economy. Well, gee, no wonder the U.S. recovery, quote, recovery, is about one-third of what is normal at this stage in a recovery. We've taken all this money out of the GDP, out of the economy. No wonder we're hobbling along at, by the way, latest estimate, 1.4% GDP growth this year. 1.4. That's all. And you know that 1.4 is before we see what happened in the third quarter of this year as a result of all this debt ceiling and government shutdown debacle. Indicators are coming in, even as we speak, that show consumer sentiment and consumer spending took a big hit in September and October. Big hit. We'll see how bad when the GDP first numbers come out. Big hit. Manufacturing is growing at 0.1%. Latest figures, 0.1%. Retail sales, including autos, are falling. Housing, forget it. Anything that was called the recovery is over. The big banks are laying off thousands of people processing mortgages now. Nothing coming there. All right, business spending. And now it looks like today, early indications are that employment growth is now beginning to soften significantly. It wasn't that great to begin with. The earlier part of this year is mostly part-time temp workers, but even that now, we will see. Probably the next numbers are not going to be that good because of the shutdown, but the numbers after that will show employment is weakening once again. All right. Well, why is that? Well, we took all this money out, and we want to negotiate even taking more out? That's incredible when you think about it. All right. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, estimated that we took out in 2012, 2 years ago, $62 billion, and we took out another $72 billion in 2013. Discretionary spending as a percent of GDP was 9.4% in 2010, and now it's 7.6%. and is projected to fall even further. Okay, that's a lot of numbers. Maybe you want to get your pencil out and write some of this down if you're really interested, or just re-listen to it, today's show once again on the archive later. All right, the point I'm making is that we've taken a huge amount of money out of the economy. That's why we got such a bumping along the bottom, 1.4% estimated for this year, and probably less than that once we factor in what's happened in the third and fourth quarters. And even that number is artificially boosted by two things. I've talked about them before on the show. One, the government redefined GDP this past summer to include corporate expenses as investment. You know, it's now considered investment, adds a positive to GDP because companies spend money on R&D. R&D is an expense, but now expenses are considered investment. It's crazy. Ah, but last year, in 2012, that added over $500 billion to GDP. Well, that's fake. You got to take that out. And that's almost a half of 1%, $500 billion of GDP. So our 1.4 is really around 1 or less. And now on top of that, you know, you have to make adjustments for inflation. And the way the government does with this index called GDP deflator underestimates inflation in order to overestimate GDP. If we looked at it using the consumer price index, that'd take another half percent. The U.S. economy, in other words, is already growing 1% or less this year before all this nonsense with shutdown, government debt ceiling extension hit. And we're beginning to see indicators showing the hit to the rest of the economy was significant in terms of spending and investment, government spending, and consumer spending and business spending. We'll see how bad here by the end of the year, early next year. But we could end up with a GDP in the fourth quarter that's pretty much flat, especially when you adjust it for this fake redefinitions, and certainly when you adjust it for a more accurate inflation indicator. We may be flat in the water, according to GDP. Now, this isn't the first time since the so-called recovery we went flat for a quarter. We went flat in the first quarter of 2011, and then we went flat again in the fourth quarter of 2012. And now we're going to, every year we have at least one quarter where there's absolutely no growth. Now, some of you may think that a recession is defined as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. No, not so. That's not how it's defined. That's how the press reports it, but that's not how it's defined. The official definition is according to the National Bureau of Economic Research economists, and they look at a whole host of indicators. Employment, retail sales, exports, and so on and so forth, industrial production, and use some formula that no one knows about, if there is a formula, and come up with some kind of consensus, whether we had a recession or not. It's not two consecutive quarters of GDP. So we could have had a GDP quarter in 2011-2012, which was absolutely zero, or damn close to it, and have been in a double-dip recession already. Okay. That all aside, I've been arguing for some time that we're heading for another true double-dip recession. And we may have already been there, by the way. It may be a triple dip coming up. But anyway, how and why could we end up in a double-dip recession? Well, as I've been saying in my writings on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and on this station and elsewhere, longer articles, a long one now, feature article called The Slowing Global Economy. That's coming out in Z Magazine of mine in a few days. And I will put it on my website if you can't get to look at it at Z. My website is kyklosproductions.com, K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com. just Google me, and you'll see Kiklos Productions. And by the end of the week, you'll be able to read why the total global economy is also slowing. And the U.S., of course, is in line with all that. Anyway, three reasons why we may have a double-dip recession. The first, of course, is this deficit-cutting nonsense continuing. It's already slowed the economy down dramatically, you know, having taken nearly $400 billion a year before the multiplier effects out of the economy between 2011 and today, and continuing to take even more out of the economy. All right. If this deficit cutting continues, it's not just the cutting of the government spending that would trip us into a double dip. It's the psychological impact of all that and the process with debt ceiling and shutdowns and so forth on consumer spending and business spending, which together are 80% of the U.S. economy. And that, as I said already, is beginning to have some indications of an impact. And if we continue with this, right, and we continue cutting even more, letting the sequester go through, and then cutting even more, as the Republicans want to do, that could be, in and of itself, sufficient to trip us into a true double-dip recession early in 2014. And that's been my prediction, always late 2013, sometime 2014, double dip potential. But it's predicated on this continuation of deficit cutting plus two other events. The second factor that may trip us is if the Federal Reserve continues to try to withdraw its so-called QE, quantitative easing, $85 billion a month, buying up bad mortgages from investors at prices we don't know anything about, because the Fed won't tell us. If that continues, or to talk of withdrawing that, you see, the QE has no effect on the real economy. The QE, that $85 billion a month, is all about putting money in the hands of speculators and investors so they can keep the stock and bond markets booming. That's the only reason why this stock market keeps going up. It's all the free money being pumped into investors' pockets by the Federal Reserve. There's no correlation here between job creation and QE. I wrote about that before. And there's no correlation with the housing market and QE. There is a big correlation between stock and bond and derivative market booms and QE. All right. But the talk of withdrawing QE, as we saw this last summer, had the effect of driving up long-term interest rates. And that's a big reason why the housing market has stalled. It's already gone up over 1%. So if long-term rates go up, continue to go up for whatever reason, that could trip the economy. And you add that to the deficit cutting, you've got a double effect. Now, third factor I've always talked about is that we could have a banking crisis in Europe. That would result in a further contraction of credit, loans by banks to real companies and real people, because of the contagion effect. Now, so far, we haven't had that banking crisis in Europe. Monetary authorities over there have been able to buy time by saying, oh, we will do whatever we have to do, like Ben Bernanke and the Fed. We'll drop money from helicopters if we got to in order to keep this. And that's been enough to placate the investors over there. But just look at the banking system in Europe. The banks have been given over $1 trillion in loans from the central bank, from ECB, European Central Bank, and they're over $1 trillion. And most of that hasn't been paid back. It has to be repaid in 2014. Right? In other words, they have to issue more loans to roll over that debt. The governments and the pan-European institutions, bailout institutions, right? That money has kept the banks from collapsing. Small ones here and there have gone under, right, and restructured, but has prevented the system from collapsing further. Now, on top of that, there have been reports that the Eurobanks have over $2 trillion in non-performing loans. In other words, $2 trillion of loans that have been made to businesses and so forth that aren't being repaid. $2 trillion. They're going to have to pump even more money into that unstable banking system of Europe. At some point, it can crack. When? Not hard to tell. But that's what they call a tail risk, coming out of nowhere, unexpected, with a big impact. So three factors could trip us into a double dip in 2014, and those are the three: continued deficit cutting, Federal Reserve rates rising, and banking crisis in Europe. Also, I would say keep a watch at China. China's got growing problems as well. They've got a housing bubble, a real estate bubble that's running amok. And every time they try to raise interest rates to cool it off, well, they slow down the real economy. Then they got to turn around and stimulate the real economy. They did that this summer, try to raise rates to cool off the housing bubble. But that didn't work. Said slow down the economy. Then they had to jump back in and re-stimulate the economy. So China's walking a tightrope over there. So why do you have such a real estate bubble going on over there? By the way, we got another one going on in the UK as well. Why? Hot money. All this extreme liquidity as a result of the Federal Reserve and central banks elsewhere pumping all this money into the economy, keep the banks from going under. The money just flows out in the U.S. into these emerging markets and these other hot speculative markets and keeps these bubbles going around the world. So they're damned if they do and damned if they don't with this monetary policy. A big contradiction in monetary policy. It's keeping the banks from immediate collapse, the financial system from immediate continued collapse, but it's breeding an even greater crisis in the future. Now, conservatives say, all this money pumping into the economy, and I'm talking about tens of trillions here since the crisis, is going to cause inflation. And liberals say, well, I don't see any inflation in real goods and services. No, there isn't. In fact, we have a problem with deflation. Wholesale prices over the past year in the U.S. have slowed down to 0.3%. That's almost deflation. We have a problem with falling prices. Well, they're not negative yet, but the rate of increase is slowing, slowing, slowing. That's a sign the economy's in trouble when you get price increases declining, declining like that, both on the consumer side and on the wholesale side, retail side and wholesale side. And that's what's going on. They just can't get prices to rise. Now, I'm talking about prices of real goods and services. What they do get prices to rise are on financial speculative securities. I'm talking about stock markets, junk bond markets, derivative markets, property markets, etc. Foreign exchange, speculation, etc. This is where all the inflation is occurring. So, conservatives are right. It causes inflation. But not in the real economy. It causes inflation in the speculative financial security side. And liberals are wrong when they say, oh, there's no inflation. Of course there is, but it's all in the speculative side. You see, neither conservatives or liberals, you know, neither John Taylor, conservative, or Paul Krugman, liberal, understand the relationship between the two price systems that aren't working in sync anymore. In other words, real prices. Liberals only look at real goods and services, don't understand the financial side. And conservatives only look at the financial side, don't understand or have a 200-year-old understanding of how the real economy works. Okay, let's move on back to this whole question of taxes. I want to talk more about taxes here in today's show. And we may continue it next week because it's such a big topic, but it's necessary to understand what's going on the tax side when you watch what's going to happen with this new negotiations. And I want to talk about corporate taxes, because the big gorilla here in these negotiations is going to be both sides' agreement to cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 28%, or something in the 20s. They're both in agreement on that. But what's holding that up is one side wants to really gut Social Security and Medicare, and the other side wants some tax loophole, smoke and mirror covers, and that's what's holding it all up, you see. Whether they can break through that secondary issue logjam to get their corporate tax cuts is the game. We'll see how that works out. So I want to talk about corporate taxes here. I want to talk about corporation share of total government tax revenue. I want to talk about corporations' effective tax rates. I want to talk about corporations' tax payments as a percent of total government revenue, as a percent of their profits. And I want to talk about what's happening with multinational corporations and what's happening with the race to the bottom between states and loopholes here today. And we'll come back. That's a good plate to discuss in the second half of this program. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about corporate taxes. What are some of the facts versus the myths and fictions about corporate taxes and government revenues? This is Jack Rasmus. We'll take a short break here.
Sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood.
This is Alternative Visions, your host, Jack Rasmus. We're talking now about taxes, particularly the corporate tax. Okay, there's three and a half major kinds of federal taxes. What are they? There's the personal income tax, there's the corporate income tax, and there are payroll taxes, and then miscellaneous excise taxes and so forth. Okay. Now, I'm not going to talk about the personal income tax. That was the fiscal cliff deal. Right? Personal income tax is really divided between taxes on what's called wages and earned income, salaries, wages and salaries, and taxes on capital incomes. In other words, capital gains and dividends and so forth. Let's put that personal income tax thing aside for now. Let's also put the payroll tax aside. Payroll tax for Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. Let's talk about the corporate income tax. Because what's coming in these negotiations in this tax code overhaul bill working through Congress is focused on corporate taxes significantly. You see, there are patterns, there are trends in corporate and U.S. tax legislation over the last three decades. What are some of those trends? We'll talk about them more in subsequent weeks, but what are some of those trends? Well, one trend is a shift in total government tax revenues from corporate taxes to other forms of taxes, payroll taxes and personal income taxes. Corporations are paying less and less as a share of total government tax revenue over the decades. That's one trend. Okay, another trend is capital incomes, okay, within the personal income tax, capital incomes, meaning capital gains, dividends, and so forth, that's declining as a share of personal income taxes. Like corporate taxes as a total share are declining in relationship to all the rest, and within personal income taxes, we got this shift going on. So we got a shift inside of a shift. But I'm not going to talk about personal income taxes. But those are two trends, right? Now, another trend is these two shifts are significantly contributing to the growth of income inequality in the United States. That's another topic. By the way, I've written on that earlier. You can read that in my articles in Z, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, on my website. Okay. So those are three trends, but we're going to put those aside for now. All right. There is a race to the bottom in corporate taxation between states. States are giving each other, or are trying to steal corporate headquarters from each other to create jobs by giving huge handouts, awards, tax cuts, tax breaks to corporations to move their headquarters from California to Texas. The governor of Texas is making a big effort to do this. He comes to California all the time. Perry tries to get companies to move out of California for less taxes in Texas. Okay, a race to the bottom between the states, which reduces the state's take on corporate income taxes, which means the states have to then turn around and raise sales taxes or property tax, other kinds of taxes on the rest of us. Now, there's also this kind of race to the bottom going on globally. Some countries have been cutting their taxes to lure companies from the U.S. To their countries, set up their headquarters in other countries. One of the most egregious examples of this is Ireland. We'll talk about that shortly. And multinational corporations are playing that violin to great effect. And we'll see. Netherlands is another one. Bermuda is another one, etc. I'll talk a little bit more about that race to the bottom globally. But there's a race to the bottom trend within the states and the U.S., and there's a race to the bottom globally as well. Okay. Now, there's another interesting trend that's been occurring for 30 years, and that is legislators in Congress, let's talk about the federal level, right? Legislators usually don't take on tax cutting of wealthy individuals, the personal income tax, at the same time they take on tax cutting for corporations. It's usually a 1-2 punch. That's what happened in the 1980s under Reagan. They cut personal income taxes first, then they cut corporate income taxes. It happened on steroids under George W. Bush, you know. Big cuts to personal income taxes in 2001, 2, and 3 under Bush, most of which were personal capital income taxes, you know, capital gains, dividends, and so forth, inheritance, etc. All those were cut significantly. In three successive years, 2001, 2, and 3, amounted to, you know, over $3 trillion over the decade. Then Obama extended it two more years, and then we had the fiscal cliff. It would have extended for another decade, starting this year, would have cost $4.6 trillion loss of revenue. And the fiscal cliff deal, as I reported last week, was really how letting $4 trillion of that go through. So we had over $3 trillion under the Bush tax cuts in the last decade, and now we have another $4 trillion in tax cuts under Obama in this decade, now made permanent. Okay, that's personal income tax, 2001, 2, and 3, 80% of which went to the wealthiest households. All right, few crumbs thrown through the rest of us, you know, education credits and child care credits and so forth. But the vast majority of it went to wealthy households. Okay, but people aren't so aware of what happened in 2004, 5, and 6, and that's when the corporate tax cuts came. Not in one big bill, but this industry, you know, and then that industry, and then this loophole for, you know, these companies, and so on and so forth. That's how they passed the corporate tax cuts. So there's this alternating between tax cuts for investors, wealthy households, tax cuts for their corporations. Of course, there's a big connection between the two, isn't there? Sure, it's the corporations that pass the money to these investors. So if you cut corporate taxes, they can pass more through to their investors. And then when the investors get it, if you cut capital gains and dividends and so forth, well, then they get to keep more of the more that's been passed through to them. So they're two sides of the same coin, you see, corporate taxes and capital personal income taxes. And we've been alternating this. I talked about this between 1980 and 2005 in my book, The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush, showing how, as a result of these tax cuts for corporations and for the rich, investors and so forth, plus other means, other policies, you know, destroying unions and free trade and offshoring and reducing wages and benefits and so forth, how every year by 2004, $1 trillion has been shifted from earned middle-class, working-class folks making wages and salaries, shifted to wealthy investors in the corporations. Okay. By the way, that was before everyone else discovered, you know, income inequality, which has been finally on the map in the last couple of years. A little liberals writing about this everywhere, not saying what to do about it, but writing about it. That's good. Yeah, where others have been talking about it a decade ago, before it became popular. Most notably, Professor Emmanuel Saez of UC Berkeley did the originating yeoman work on this. Whenever you see information about 1%, how much the 1% are doing in terms of gaining income share, that's Professor Saez's work, started in 2002. Okay, so what are some of the other trends? A long-term trend towards tax avoidance by corporations by offshoring. I'll explain a little bit about that too, right? And rising tax contributions of revenue loss as a cause of deficit and debt run-up. Okay, what does that mean? That means that if you look at our run-up in our total deficit and debt in the U.S. since 2000, you know, total federal debt was about $5.5 trillion. You know, now it's around $17 trillion, right? Under Bush, it almost doubled from 5.5 to almost 10 trillion. And then, of course, it's increased significantly because of what? Well, 60%, at least 60% of the deficit, and therefore the debt, is because of declining tax revenues in this country. It's not because of increasing spending, it's declining tax revenues. And by the way, on the spending side, it's mostly defense spending and rip-offs on the healthcare side and interest on the debt and so forth. It's not increases. And there's a little bit there in terms of spending on trying to get the bailouts. Okay, 60% is declining tax revenue is a problem. Now, tax revenue declines because of all the tax cuts you give to corporations and wealthy folks, but also declines because you can't get the economy going, you can't get jobs, high-paying jobs, full-time jobs, creation going. Those folks pay taxes, both the businesses they work for and the workers themselves. So if you don't get a real robust job creation going, which we haven't for 4 years now, well, then your tax revenues are going to decline. And at the same time, if you're giving tax cuts and tax cuts and tax cuts to corporations and the rich, it's declined even more. That's why 60% of the problem of deficits and debt is tax revenues. Okay, so let's move on. Those are some of the trends. We'll talk about those trends more. I think we're probably going to need another session to cover this tax picture, but it's extremely important to understand the facts as you watch what's going on with this Committee of 29. All right, some facts about corporate tax ripoff. Corporate taxes as a percent of total government revenue. What's the facts? What's the picture there? How has that changed over the years, recent years? Right? And what about taxes as a percent of profits, corporate profits? What's that picture look like? What's the effective tax rate that corporations are paying? Okay, let's take each one of these. Get your pencil out. All right. Taxes as a percent of GDP, U.S. GDP. Okay. And then taxes as a percent of total U.S. tax revenue. I'm talking about federal side here, right? Taxes as a percent of total U.S. tax revenue. In the 1950s, the corporate income tax was more than 30% of total government, federal government revenues. The corporate income tax brought in over 30%. After World War II, it was 40%. All right, by 2010, right, it had dropped to 9%. In other words, we had 30% in the 50s. In the 60s, it ranged between 15 and 20%. In 1982, when Reagan came in with his big tax cuts for corporations and the rich, corporate taxes fell to around 8 to 10%, 9%. And it's been 9% ever since, from 30% to 9% of total federal revenues. And corporations are squealing, they pay too much. Okay. All right. As a percent of GDP, it has declined significantly as well. What's the effective? Well, let's back up. Corporate taxes as a percent of U.S. profits. Previously as a percent of total U.S. tax revenue. How about as a percent of U.S. profits? Listen to this. Okay. Between 1987 and 2008, corporate taxes as a percent of U.S. corporate profits was 25%. In the 1960s, it was 40%. In other words, corporations were paying 40% of their profits in the 1960s, on average, in the form of the corporate income tax. You know, that's why it was 30% of total federal tax revenues. What are they paying since 2009? 12%. In other words, the average between 1987 and 2008 of 25.6% of profits paid in corporate income taxes was halved, more than reduced by half, and it stayed there the last 4 years, around 12%. Okay. Microsoft paid 33% of its profits in 1987 in corporate income tax. Today, they pay less than 10% of their profits. Of course, their profits are much greater than they ever were. Right? What's the effective U.S. corporate tax rates? You hear a lot about, oh, the tax rate's too high, it's too high. You know, right now it's 35%. You know, when Reagan came into office, you know, it was over 50%. Now it's 35%. Oh, but that's before you got all these loopholes and all these subsidies, you know, all the ways that they can effectively reduce what they pay. Effective means what they actually pay. All right, when Reagan comes into office, it's 50%. What they actually were paying, 33%. Okay. By 1995, they actually were paying the rate, the tax rate, right, the effective tax rate, 31%. 2005, 25%. 2009, 19%. 2010, and since, 12.6%. There's been this free fall in the effective tax rate that corporations have been paying. And that's why their share of total government taxes has gone down. That's why their share of taxes as a percent of their profits has gone down. Now, this 12.6% is from the Government Accounting Office. Okay, so, defenders of corporations say, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, that's not counting what they pay in foreign taxes and in state taxes and in local taxes. You know, you've got to look at the whole picture. Well, okay, let's look at the whole picture. 2010. 16.9%. When you take what they're paying all around the world, when you take what they're paying in state and local taxes, it's still only 16.9%. And that is before you factor in any tax deduction due to depreciation write-offs. Right? In other words, this is taxes as a percent of profits. Take the aggregate taxes the corporations pay in 2010, divided by aggregate profits, pre-tax profits, and what you get is 16.9% globally, and all state and local. Right? But that's before you consider any depreciation write-offs, which have been getting more and more generous. So, in other words, it's less than 16.9%. It's probably close to around 10 to 14%, I would say. Foreign profits income. Oh, you know, they claim and they cry about, oh, they're paying so much in foreign profits, you know, and then they get taxed on if they bring the money back here. Well, that's not true either. Right. Let's look at some of those figures. What are they actually paying offshore? Right. What are they paying offshore? About 3 to 4%. Effectively. Well, how do these multinational companies get away paying only 3 to 4%? Actually, 3.6%. Okay. Well, that's where we get into this multinational company offshore tax shelter game. Big tax shelter game. What is that? Oh, you may have heard about Apple in the news, Apple Computer, right, and Google and so forth. Have you heard about the double Irish loophole? Have you heard about the Dutch sandwich loophole? Have you heard about check-the-box loophole and look-through rule loopholes? These are ways in which multinational corporations take advantage of moving their money around totally legal by U.S. laws, keeping it offshore so they don't bring it back and pay anything, and actually moving it around offshore from place to place so they don't have to pay the offshore governments anything either. The case of Apple takes advantage of what's called the double Irish loophole. What is that? To move profits from Ireland to Bermuda. Right. First of all, they claim all their profits in Ireland, then they move them to Bermuda. And Bermuda has less than 5% tax. Apple saved $9 billion in U.S. taxes in 2012, avoided $9 billion in U.S. taxes in just 2012 by taking advantage of the double Irish loophole, in other words, claiming all their profits through Ireland. No, and then moving it to Bermuda. Don't ask me all the details how they do it. You've got to be a tax lawyer. And then what about the case of Google? Oh, the Dutch sandwich. What is that? Google saved $13 billion, paid a tax rate of 5%, right? Routing their profits through the Netherlands to avoid withholding taxes. That's called the Dutch sandwich. And you can combine them two, you know. You can have a double Irish Dutch sandwich. Okay? In European countries, they don't end up getting tax revenue any more than we did. In 2004, multinational corporations paid 2.3% tax rate on foreign profits of $700 billion. And then what did the government do? The government said, okay, we're going to give you instead of 35% tax rate, if you bring that money back, you know, you only have to pay 5.25%. Well, they ended up paying 3.6%. They bought $300 billion back. They were supposed to create jobs. They didn't. They used it to buy back stock and buy other companies. And now they're saying they want the same thing again. This has been part of this tax code overhaul thing. They want a 8 to 10% tax rate. And you know how much they're holding offshore now? Over $2 trillion. Multinational corporations are sheltering $2 trillion in their offshore subsidiaries, refusing to bring it back and pay taxes. And nothing's happening. No one's doing anything to them. And as I said, they accumulate this through the double Irish and the Dutch sandwich and check the box and so on and so forth. Okay. We're going to talk more about this tax issue. We haven't talked about the state and global race to the bottom on the tax issue. We will talk about that next week and other issues relating to the tax code overhaul that's beginning to work its way through Congress. David Kemp, T-Publican, Chair of House Ways and Means, and Max Baucus, a Republican and Democrat cloth, you know, in the Senate. These are the guys who are working this deal. And it's going to make its way into these negotiations somehow, and we're going to have another big corporate tax cut, which means even more cuts to discretionary spending and entitlements will have to occur if this goes through. Okay, we'll talk about that again next week. Come back for Tax Rip-Off Part 2. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.